Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to best-selling author Max Altshuler, the CEO of Sales Hacker, author of Hacking Sales, and his brand new book coming in March 2018 called Career Hacking for Millennials. Max has helped build three multi-million dollar businesses to date, and he still has his hand in a lot of different companies, whether they're side projects like his new venture Sutra Coffee or as an investor and advisor to nearly 40 SaaS startups. Originally from Long Island, New York, Max went to college at Arizona State University, where he got his first real taste for business. He and a few friends won a business plan competition, got a $2,000 grant, and started building out a campus-wide bike sharing program that was backed by the university. But this was 2009, and the U.S. was in the depths of one of the deepest recessions we've seen in nearly a lifetime. So Max and his partners couldn't get the funding they needed to grow their business, and they had to close down shop. However, he learned a lot from this first experience, and it eventually brought him to San Francisco, where he worked for the online education startup Udemy as their very first sales hire. After spending a couple of years building out the company's sales process, Max launched a side project called Sales Hacker, a live event that netted him a nearly $60,000 profit on his first go-round. Pretty shortly thereafter, Max dove headfirst into growing Sales Hacker into the business it is today, generating over $3 million in annual revenue from events, media partnerships, sponsorships, and products. On top of that, Sales Hacker brings in over 100,000 monthly readers to their blog. Growing that business has led Max to launching more side projects like Sutra Coffee, a healthy caffeine alternative, and to writing his new book coming out in March 2018. In this episode, Max and I talk about how he launched his very first Sales Hacker event as a side project, generated $60,000 in profit in a weekend, and quickly grew that into the $3 million business it's become today. We're digging into how Max has built a highly engaged following on his blog, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, where he's had posts that get surfaced to more than 800,000 people. We're covering Max's best advice for people who want to launch an online and offline business today, how he's growing his current side project, Sutra Coffee, and what it took him to launch a best-selling business book. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Max Altshuler. Max, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I want to start this off by hearing, what book are you reading right now, or what's been your favorite recently?
I really liked the book American Kingpin. It's a story of the Silk Road, you know, like drug trafficking website. It was really good. The whole story of how it went down and how they took down the guy and how he had like, you know, I don't know, like $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. It was pretty insane.
Yeah, I remember that story when it was in the news. It was wild. Did they actually confirm that that was him?
Yeah, you know, I think his family was trying to say that he was set up, but, you know, it was pretty clearly him. And the detail that they go into the story with the FBI and the IRS and everybody tracking him was pretty incredible.
Man, really relevant today too, right? With cryptocurrency exploding as it is.
Yeah, you know, that guy'd probably be the richest guy in the world right now if he were out of prison and still had all that Bitcoin.
All right. Well, hey, I want to talk about you. So let's go back to the very beginning with you. Where are you originally from?
I'm from Long Island, Syosset, Long Island, right off New York City.
All right. And did you grow up there, you know, all the way through high school, college? How long did you stay in Long Island area?
First 18 years in Long Island, went off to Arizona State, ended up in Arizona for about 5 years. Towards the end of college, tried to start a bike share program with the ones you see in New York and San Francisco, and didn't work out. Ended up traveling a bunch, spent some time in Costa Rica and Nicaragua, made my way up to San Francisco, did about 6 years in San Francisco, and 2 years in New York, and now heading off to Miami, actually.
All right. All over the place. Yeah. So I want to backtrack a little bit. So you mentioned, you know, being at ASU for college, the bike sharing program that you started there. What motivates you to start that? Why invest your time into bike sharing?
So I was an architecture major, and I actually did a study abroad for a year in Barcelona, which is, you know, a dream come true for anybody into architecture. And while I was over there, they had these bike shares where you could, swipe your card, take a bike out, ride it to another location in the city, and lock it into another rack. And I thought that would be amazing at Arizona State, flat campus, really hot, not getting, completely underutilized areas of campus. There are parking lots that they charge, $500 per semester for that people don't buy spots in because it's too far away. But imagine if they were able to quickly and easily access a bike that would get them to class. It would benefit the university big time. And they were big on kind of environmentalism. So it made a lot of sense. So when I got back from my abroad in Barcelona, went back to school, applied for this business plan competition and won a $2,000 grant, which, at the time was a lot of money to me in college, and, kept jamming on it. So we got exclusive rights to commercial bike sharing at ASU contracts signed off by, the head of procurement. We had the racks approved, the locations by the university architect signed. We were working with student government. We were working with other municipalities like transportation and a city of Tempe. But it was in 2009, so we couldn't raise the money. Three 22-year-olds trying to raise money for a bike manufacturing and bike rack manufacturing business right out of the recession was just pretty brutal. So I'm really glad it didn't work out, but it was an amazing learning experience because it would have been such a headache with the liabilities for insurance and legal purposes.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. So this was kind of being operated as a for-profit venture, just kind of like in partnership with the university.
Exactly. I mean, they were pretty happy with it because they didn't have to run it. We would come in, run it. We would take ad revenue. And that's how those things make money. It's not from the people who pay for it. Like that kind of keeps it in business. It's the ad revenue that really, make it profitable. But I'm not really even sure how well City Bike and some of these other ones are doing.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. But I mean, I guess at the bottom line, maybe why the university was most interested in it was because it is a good service for the students, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. So this was really, would you say it's your first sort of business venture?
Yeah, I'd say that's my first formal one. When I was when I was a kid in elementary school, I'd sell my Halloween candy on the bus, and then as I got older, I memorized all the values to like Pokemon cards and would like trade them up and then go to the flea market, sell them and, make money doing that. CD burning business, like whatever I could do, I did in, elementary school, middle school, high school and kind of worked my way up. But this was definitely my first like foray into, kind of building on a formal business like this.
I love it. All right. Well, fast forwarding a little bit now, you said earlier that you eventually made your way to San Francisco, and I liked your phrasing, you did time for 6 years there, right? What was your first job when you got to San Francisco?
So after the bike share program failed, graduated college and wanted to make American money while studying abroad, picked social media for small businesses. Ended up running that from Costa Rica and Nicaragua for about 5 months. That's a story for another time. But parlayed that into getting the job as the first sales hire for a marketplace called Udemy. And they had raised a seed round of funding. They had like 5 employees in the U.S. and a couple in Ankara, Turkey. And built out the supply side of the marketplace for Udemy, through their seed A and B rounds. So went to San Francisco, didn't know anybody. Willed my way into that job and kind of never looked back, but spent 6 years out there, about 2 of those at Udemy.
All right. And so while you were there, you were sort of building out like the VIP instructors and recruiting people to come teach on the platform, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So originally it was just building out the processes to get anybody teaching on the platform. And then it kind of evolved to, all right, let's go out and get some whales. Can we go out and get, Simon Sinek or Seth Godin or Guy Kawasaki, people like that.
Do you remember how many, students were actually on the platform in Udemy back when you started?
I don't remember the number of students. I think we were adding like 5 high quality courses per month when I started. And by like my third month, we were doing 50 high quality courses a month, and our quality definitions were much higher. So we just really needed a process and somebody to run it. And, you know, before I showed up, our COO was doing all the work on that. So, you know, once they got somebody in place who was kind of entrepreneurial, and, you know, when you run a marketplace, you basically run two businesses at the same time. You have your supply and demand side. So they needed somebody who would come in and take over the supply side and run it as if it was its own business.
All right. Well, let's jump forward a little bit to talk more about Sales Hacker, which is what I really want to dig into today. Yeah. So can you tell, you know, our audience listening here today who may not be familiar with Sales Hacker, what exactly it is?
Yeah. So Sales Hacker is a media company, and we help B2B salespeople sell better. So build modern processes, use modern technologies, anything from like tactics, tips, and strategies in your sales force. So, you know, you can go to our blog and see posts, you know, ranging from how to build a sales development team to every, you know, SaaS sales metric you need to know. And it's not just SaaS, but it's definitely focused on tech at the moment. But a lot of the writings, a lot of the teachings kind of work for every industry as long as it's business to business. And we do, you know, blog posts, webinars, virtual events, and then three big conferences a year in New York, San Francisco, and London.
Yeah, I see your guys' content everywhere, which I guess is a good sign.
Yeah, that's great. That's what I want to hear.
So going back to the very early days of Sales Hacker, you know, take us back to what year that was and maybe, you know, what the product was like, or what the website was like, rather, back when it very first started.
Oh, man. So when I was at Udemy, I was doing some really cool stuff in terms of growing our instructor base. And anytime, you know, somebody asked, you know, our founders, you know, what we were doing, they'd say, talk to Max. So I ended up meeting some really cool people who were doing, you know, other unique things in their sales processes. And we started this little meetup, you know, Sales Hacker meetup. And so I went from Udemy to a company called Attorney Fee. We sold Attorney Fee to LegalZoom. And then I didn't really want to go work for anybody else, but I didn't know what I wanted to do yet. So I said to my meetup, you know, who here would be interested if we threw a conference around this? I got a couple of hands raised, and I had two people in there that were down to, you know, foot the bill. They were going to sponsor it. So I walked out of there with some really good speakers, some sponsorship money, and turned it into a 300-person sales conference. Took me 4 weeks to throw, made $60,000 in profit. I was like, hey, maybe I have something here. So next thing we did was we put out the blog, the publication, and I wrote, you know, a bunch of the original content. And then we had a couple guests, you know, posters or contributors, and we started doing meetups. We did meetups in 32 cities globally. And then it just kind of kept snowballing and went bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, we had partnerships with Salesforce, Marketo, LinkedIn, Adobe, kind of anybody in the sales and marketing space that really cares about kind of forward thinking, innovation, and you know in revenue, and you know, kind of just it rolled into this. I really had no plan from the get go, other than people seem to like this and need this, and we'll just keep going. And now it's a real company with real revenues, and I think we get about 100,000 visitors a month now to the blog. You know, we've done conferences for, you know, 2,000 people at a time. So pretty exciting.
Yeah, I love that you guys started with the in-person event at first, because it, you know, it doesn't take a ton of time, money, effort. You know, you're not like investing years of time trying to build up the traffic to a website before you know if people really want content on this topic from you guys. So I love those origins. Are live events still a big part of the business today?
Yeah, definitely. Not as big as I planned for them to be. And, you know, you have to be cognizant of the market. You know, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of conferences. It's very easy for companies to do. And a lot of companies are throwing a lot of money at it because it's really good lead gen for them. So it's hard to differentiate. So we've definitely downplayed the conferences a little bit after our spike. But you know, we're kind of keeping steady instead of growing them like wildly year after year. And I think that's the right way to do it. But you know, I never wanted to raise any money. I always wanted to do this like the natural way, bootstrapped. We did about $3 million in revenue last year just for Sales Hacker. I've helped launch two other conference business media companies while running Sales Hacker, CMX for community managers and Saster for basically everybody in SaaS, so in software. So it's kind of created this interesting springboard into other things.
Yeah. I mean, you have side projects coming out of Sales Hacker, essentially, collaborations.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm an advisor in about 40 different SaaS companies. That's been one thing, just kind of like diversifying and, being able to work with other founders and help them with their sales processes, but also getting visibility. You know, that's how they find me. Building a network, you know, that is a transferable asset. You know, after Sales Hacker, you know, I'm sure I'm going to go on and do something else, but being able to have, you know, the network that I built, you know, is pretty awesome. The reputation, the experience and the knowledge of building a company, doing it bootstrapped and not having any bosses kind of breathing down my neck is, you know, also pretty good. So there's a lot of like ancillary benefits. And then, yeah, the side projects, Sales Hacker is a cash flow business. So I've been able to do some things, you know, like Sutra, for example, that I wouldn't have been able to do, because I have, you know, cash flow to use and, you know, my network, I have operators in that I can tap into. So, Sutra is a healthy coffee alternative made from superfoods that we just spun out. Not spun out of Sales Hacker, but I was able to use my Sales Hacker resources to create.
Mm-hmm. How is Sutra doing, by the way, now?
Great.
We've been
6 weeks and we did 11.5K in sales just through Shopify. And we just closed our first chain of coffee shops in New York City and Brooklyn. So we have a buddy of mine who's doing distribution, like wholesale coffee shops, hotels, restaurants, and then another employee who's doing all the marketing and Shopify, Amazon type stuff.
I like that. So you guys are going B2B and B2C at the same time?
Yeah.
Awesome. So, you know, a few minutes ago you mentioned something that I want to dig into, having a network that's transferable and, you know, being an advisor to so many different SaaS startups currently. And I think one thing that's probably helped you in doing that, aside from just Sales Hacker, was the book that you released a few years ago now, Hacking Sales, which became a bestseller. Can you tell us about sort of what your process of writing that book looked like?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I wrote that book in about 6 days from a pool in Bali. I wanted to write an ebook on the process that I used at Udemy. And I thought I had some very unique, you know, pieces of that process that I was, you know, blogging about here and there. And so I had a trip planned, about a 2-week trip between Australia, Singapore, and Bali. And Australia and Singapore will work, you know, like I mentioned before, we had meetups in 32 cities globally. So we had meetups going in these cities, you know, and I went down there to kind of meet the people who are running them, you know, meet the sponsors, meet, you know, some of the local, VPs of sales. On the way, it's about a 12-hour flight. I spent probably 10 of those hours building the outline for the book. When I finished the outline, I realized the outline was about 15 pages. I was like, oh man, this is going to be a lot more than an ebook. Whatever. I'll write it. We'll see. Maybe we'll break it up, you know, chapter by chapter. And when I got to Bali, I had like 7 days carved out in the Gili Islands, which is like, you know, kind of sleepy. There's really nothing else going on to write. So I sit down when I get to Gili and I, you know, get my laptop out. And I actually made them go get me my like personal Wi-Fi, my own little hotspot, so that it wouldn't crap out on me. And just sat there and cranked for like 16 hours a day. And I was in the zone. And I can kind of get like that. I did that on my most recent book just now in Bali. Did the same thing, wrote another book, same length. But I cranked out about 30,000 words for that first book in about 6 days. And it was really, you know, it was a brain dump for me. It was, you know, here's the outline, here's the process, here's everything I know about it. And it just kind of worked seamlessly. That flow, you know, really worked for me. And, you know, I was able to get it, you know, kind of everything in my head all out on paper.
I'm glad you said that it was a brain dump for you, because in my experience, that's when, you know, when I'm writing something that I just know so well that it just flows from my head straight onto the, you know, the paper, the computer, whatever, that's when you know you're really onto a topic that you should keep writing about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's something I always wanted to write on. I just didn't know how much I really had in there. And, you know, once I put it on paper, putting stuff on paper is a really good exercise for me. And I used to do it a lot when I had virtual assistants, you know, at Udemy, who were doing a lot of the sales process, because it helps you kind of poke holes or see the holes in your process and realize, oh, well, you know, what am I doing there? I need a process for that. It seems a little like willy-nilly in that like little piece that's missing. So for example, we had like virtual assistants doing our sales development process at Udemy for a while, and kind of writing that out and systematizing that really helped us iron it out even further.
So you come back from Bali, you've got this book, you know, this rough book, I guess you could say, after just 6 days of writing. So what happens next between that and becoming a bestseller? How did you sort of engineer that? Or was it, you know, mostly luck?
Yeah. So the sales part actually wasn't hard, because I already had a, you know, at that point I already had a community of 30,000 members who were interested in sales. So getting that out and getting, you know, quick sales fast through my network, you know, my network plus our subscriber base, that wasn't hard. I knew we'd be able to push it. I never wrote a book before. So, you know, here I am sitting there with 30,000 words. I don't know if it makes sense. But, you know, next thing to do is send it around to a couple people, get their feedback on it. Feedback was pretty good, maybe made a few tweaks. Needed to find an editor. Really just wanted to self-publish it and get it out. You know, actually my personal goal was getting it out by my birthday that year. So I had like 8 weeks to get it out. And so I found an editor on Google who I did not like using, but it worked. And you know, once the book was edited, they formatted it for Kindle and CreateSpace. I had my designer at the time do a book cover, uploaded everything. And once it's on Amazon and you know, CreateSpace, anybody could order on Amazon and they get a book shipped to their house or whisper sync to their Kindle. So it's actually very easy, you know, to self-publish a book. A good book is a different story, but very easy to self-publish a book. I think my book has... between the two editions, because my book ended up getting, I sold the rights to it after 10 months to Wiley, one of the biggest publishers. And so I have two different versions on Amazon, the original one and the Wiley one. I think I got something like 80 reviews and like 4.5 stars or something like that. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, that's great. Did you end up getting any sort of like press pickup? Did you hire a PR agency? Did you do anything like that? Or was it really all sort of driven by this community you already created?
I did none of that. It was all driven by the community I created. I think for the next book, that's like a key piece, because I'm going into a slightly different demographic. But you know, for that one, I didn't need to go outside of my wheelhouse at all.
All right. Well, let's talk about that next book. It's the title, Career Hacking for Millennials, coming out March 2018. How is your process different this time?
It's slightly different, only that... So LinkedIn started rolling out something on their algorithm that allowed me to create these kind of long form pieces on my, you know, my updates and get a ton of engagement. And so I started creating, I think it's a 1300 word cap. So I started creating these 1300 word kind of LinkedIn, you know, updates on, you know, stories from my learnings or whatnot, learnings from, you know, my past. And afterwards, I'd put them on a Google Doc and write in how many views it got, how many likes it got, how many comments it got. And at some point, I realized, you know, holy shit, I have like 15,000, you know, words on this doc. Like, this could be a book. So I sent it to a buddy of mine who, you know, wrote his own book, and he's kind of an editor that I met after my last book, unfortunately. And he was like, yeah, this is great. Keep going. So we had this kind of this flow going, and I went to Bali again, set aside some time to finish it, added another 15,000 words and got to 30,000 words. Went back and forth with him on editing a bunch. So So, you know, now we're about 30,000, but really pared it down and added some new stuff, sent it out for feedback already. And now it's with a, you know, with a formal editor who's going to, you know, format it and get it out. So, you know, writing a book is really tough if you're like, I'm going to write a book. And then you like sit down and you're like, I'm going to spend 2 hours a day just writing a book. You have to like really know a topic so that it becomes really natural and some kind of a brain dump. And you almost have to do it in a way where it's like, you know, an outline or like piece by piece. And like, you know, 15,000 words in, I'm like, okay, this could be a book. You know, I got the outline, it was 15 pages long. I was like, all right, this could be a book. I think if I had both times I had been like, I'm going to write a book, it's like such a big task. I don't know if I would have been able to do it.
So let's talk promotion then. You kind of alluded to doing things differently on the promotion side as well. And, you know, we're approaching March now. This is in January of 2018. So what are you doing differently as far as promoting this upcoming book?
So the guy who I was talking about, who was somewhat of an editor and had written his own book, is also our PR guy for Sales Hacker, who we weren't working with when I hired, when I published my last book, but it's been 2 years since that book came out. So I actually ended up giving him like a commission on book sales in exchange for, you know, some work that he can do on PR. So I planned to go that route, you know, get into a lot of the digests that my audience reads. And then obviously kind of promo partners. So, you know, can you get on podcasts or webinars or, you know, write blog posts or whatever for those types of people. But really the number one thing is continuing those LinkedIn posts. You know, I had one LinkedIn post, I got 800,000 views on it. And I think like 10,000, you know, likes, 12,000 likes. So if you can keep writing those in little subsections of the book and plug in the book, I think you can do a pretty good job selling the hell out of this thing. So we'll see. I mean, I'm not even in the headspace yet of really formalizing a promo plan, but I got some ideas.
All right. Well, we'll be watching and waiting. Max, I want to transition over into some of my frequently asked questions now. So I've designed them to be short on my end, but your answers do not need to be equally so.
Okay.
What's your number one piece of advice to someone today who wants to start an online business?
Number one piece of advice. Oh man. Find something that you're passionate about, but also has really good margins and a lot of potential buyers.
What kinds of sacrifices have you had to make in order to put enough time and effort into growing your different businesses over the years?
Ooh, I mean, I moved out to San Francisco. I didn't know one person when I could have been in New York with all my best friends from high school, you know, a year or two out of college. I probably gave up two of the best years of my life. I mean, that's a huge sacrifice, you know, to go out there and cut my teeth and, you know, be heads down, you know, in a startup that I thought, you know, could change the world and be something big. And, you know, it has, it, you know, we kind of willed it into existence. And a lot of people, you know, have a lot of brilliant people have worked on that business, and it's really, really gone far. But I'd say that's the main sacrifice, is just, you know, where I spend my time versus where I probably would have spent it if I didn't want to make that sacrifice. If I only cared about like a 9-to-5 job, or didn't care about getting so deep into, you know, tech and really learning the space, you know, I could have stayed in New York and done it the other way. But you got to cut your teeth. And, you know, I definitely sacrificed pay and my ego, you know, a bunch along the way. So, you know, that's fine. Yeah,
that's a big one. And you know, looking back at it, you also walked away from that job with a ton of relationships that have, I'm sure, helped you in many different ways moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that was the key thing. If I had stayed in New York, I could probably get a job at a startup. Yeah. But, you know, I would still go out after work with my high school friends and, you know, the people that were back in New York that I knew, and keep doing that, you know, same old thing. But in San Francisco, I worked really late because I didn't know anybody. When I did go out, I went out with people from my industry who were all like new people to meet. So the sacrifice paid off because, you know, I was able to build my network in a, you know, in a targeted industry instead of reverting to, you know, what I knew. It was fun. I got outside of my comfort zone. So, yeah.
I love that. Do you have any particular strategies, ideas, tactics that you've tested over the years that have turned out as a failure? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, probably like a million different things. What comes to mind though? What's been a failure? I mean, I got into SaaS investing and I wouldn't say like I have any failures, but I definitely would have like, if I can go back in time, go a little slower, like realize I didn't need to. I felt like I got some opportunities and I had to take advantage of those opportunities. So I put money into some companies where, like, looking back on it, not because of how they're doing, but because of like just pure experience, I didn't have to rush. Like, what was the rush to go be an investor or get involved in these companies? Like, it almost was more of like an ego thing, just, you know, to be an investor and be involved with some other, like, you know, in companies that big VCs were in. Then it was like, I really believe in this team or this product, or that I even have to do this with my money right now. So that's like, it's definitely something I think, you know, I'd answer that question with. There's plenty of like little things here and there. I mean, with failure, you gotta have thick skin. You gotta like recap it post-mortem. What can I learn from it? And then move on. So I don't know. If I give it more time, I could probably think of a million things.
No, I think that's a good takeaway though. So Max, this is going to be my last question for you. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? So that could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
Off the top of my head, and probably the honest answer is like investing in people. I had an opportunity, you know, last year to hire something that was like good enough and cheap, or something that was amazing and really expensive. And I went with amazing and really expensive, and our business has grown exponentially since. And, you know, I had to learn that lesson almost like, jumping off a cliff and learning to fly on the way down. Cause it was it could have been a negative, very negative experience if it didn't work out. But you really got to invest in people. And over time, you realize that there's no room for mediocrity. You can afford it. You know, we're a bootstrap company and we can't war on talent. You know, you're going to go work for Slack or you're going to go work for us. Like, they can give you big cushy offices and, you know, 401ks and, you know, top of the line salaries and, you know, brand new MacBooks and all that kind of stuff. We're bootstrapped. We can't, you know, they raised $500,000. We didn't raise anything. It's really tough to compete, but you know, that's why you have to be really good at seeking out serendipitous opportunities and pulling the trigger when you can, and you know, just kind of trusting your gut.
I love that. All right. Well, Max, thank you for joining us here. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you, Sales Hacker, and all the other projects you're up to?
Yeah. So you can learn more about me on Twitter, Max Altz. I'm very active on Instagram, Sales Hacker Max, and on LinkedIn, of course, Max Altschuler, Altschuler, although it's probably in front of you. You can find us at saleshacker.com if you're in B2B sales or, you know, tech in general. And then, you know, we just released a healthy coffee alternative called Sutra at sipsutra.com. So if you're looking for, you know, to get off the caffeine or just limit, you know, down to maybe one or two cups a day, it's a really good alternative, really good for you. And then Hacking Sales is the first book on Amazon, and Career Hacking for Millennials will be out March of 2018. So if you're listening to this after that, check out Amazon.
Beautiful. Well, all right. Thank you again for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.